345-54321. I think it's ready. All right.
W.S. Thackeray continuing with Air Marshal Dunlap on the 6th of May, 1980. Okay, sir? There you are.
Yes, well, we were in the year 1939 when we broke off last session, and I had just returned from the U.K., where I'd been for 2 years doing an advanced armament course. We discussed the thing a little bit, the events of early 1939, concerning the Royal Tour and such matters as that, and the fact that I had just taken over as what was known as the Armament Advisor's Post on the in the Air Staff Division and Air Force Headquarters in Ottawa. I don't think I mentioned that I was, for the first 2 months of my time there, I was working side by side with a Royal Air Force officer who, and a Royal Air Force Armament officer who was in exchange duty to Canada and whose term was just about to terminate. And I was therefore in the process of taking over from him during my... got back from the UK, and his term of office in Canada ended about mid-April, so we had a month or so of overlap. I guess we had a little bit more than that because he was getting married to a Canadian girl before he went back to the UK, and so my first... duties at Ottawa were very much related to squad leader John Easton, as he was, not to be confused with the RCF John Easton, who also was at headquarters at the time, but this is squad leader John Easton, RAF. We we worked side by side in the office. We he was good enough to let me use a room in his flat because I hadn't yet at that time reestablished my own home in Ottawa. My wife was still in Vancouver visiting. So we worked together, we lived together, and I helped him get go through the preparatory stages to, of getting married, and served as his best man at the wedding. So that period was quite deeply involved with Jack Easton. I should just interpolate here, I guess, that he went on after his return to the UK to a very distinguished career in intelligence. He had the right type of mind for that ability and became the head of one of the important intelligence divisions during the war, and was knighted at the end of the war, or short—I shouldn't say at the end of the war, but nothing but shortly thereafter for his efforts in that regard, and had quite a distinguished career. one or two things about our activities on the social side at that time. I remember very clearly social activity in the mess in the spring of that year. The mess, the RCF mess that served the Air Force Headquarters was also was the same mess that served the RCF station at Rockland. We didn't have a headquarters mess at the time. So from time to time, mess dinners were held at the Rockcliffe Mess, in which the principal participants were headquarters staff. On this again, and on occasions like that, generally there were distinguished guests invited in for the evening. This particular one, I think of in April, I think it was. The guests of the evening were mainly, I think, drawn from the Montreal area, including Billy Bishop and Frank McGill and certain distinguished airmen from that chief of the air staff at the time, or yes, he was by that time, and distinguished by the title chief of the air staff, was ABM Croyle, Air Vice Marshal Croyle. Croyle was not an outgoing type. I don't think he ever liked mess dinners. He didn't like that type of function too much. It was a bit contrary to his nature. He wasn't the type that could enter energetically into.
And I dare say they were pretty energetic, especially after dinner, I dare.
That's right. Well, that had been the tradition through the years. And a mess dinner really wasn't a mess dinner, certainly to the young Air Force officers, unless you got down to the fun and games afterwards. Because the dinner itself was quite formal, you know. You followed all the traditional customs, and there was a good deal of formality to it, so you had to let out steam afterwards. You got to balance the formality. But things got very informal as time went on. Well, the mess at Rossus was an interesting place. I don't know whether you yourself have seen it.
No,
but
it had been
the original dome, very attractive gray limestone structure, the farmhouse of the surrounding of the properties on which the airfield was built. Or at least I should say at the property on the top of the escarpment. The airfield was a bit below that. The airfield actually had been a rifle range, an army rifle range in the earlier stages. But overlooking that rifle range is this nice farm area and this nice farmhouse, and that was converted by gradual steps and stages into an official mess. When I first went there, it was just four rooms on the ground floor, and I guess about the same number upstairs, which we used for single officers, and we shared them through the rooms, so we couldn't accommodate that many people. And the dining room itself was quite small. Well, with each passing year, it seemed there was an addition put out here, an addition put out there. And by the time 1939 came along, we had a nice new addition, which gave us quite a sizable anteroom. And we were able to push the dining room out at one end to make it large enough to have a reasonably sized dinner, but it still was a little bit on the fine side. It was the original dining room of the farmhouse, and even extended it was still somewhat limited. But we did have this new games room, and there was a billiard table at one end, and messes in those days always had a billiard table.
Oh,
snooker were the popular games. So after dinner on this occasion, and things had been going a little bit slowly, Croyle engineered a game on the snooker table. And he had people like Bredner, and you can't get too many people in that type of game, of course. He had Billy Bishop and Bredner and Frank McGill, I think, and himself playing snooker. And immediately adjacent to the billiard table, of course, was the open area of the rest of the anteroom, or I suppose it was an anteroom games room. And the young chaps around about were getting a little edgy. If you got a little bit rambunctious, it was going to interfere with these distinguished people at the snooker table. But if you didn't get a little bit rambunctious, the evening was going to fall a bit flat. Well, you can imagine what prevailed. In a due course, the traditional games came before, and Buck and High Cock Alarm and Hi-Ho, Moriarty, and all these things were underway. Do you know Buck?
I don't know that one, no.
Yeah.
No. Not by the name, anyway.
Yeah, well, that's the it's sort of a football type game. It in some respects resembles the scrum in rugger, in which you form up at the two teams, and you get pretty rugged fellows. And the anchor man has his shoulder to the wall on one side of the room, and extending. Everyone gets down to crouch position with shoulder to rear end of the fellow ahead. And you get about, depending on the size of your teams, you get a half dozen or more people lined up, maybe 8 people lined up, in the sort of a elongated scrum formation, except that it's more or less people in tandem rather than spread out in a wedge. And the opposing team runs across the room at speed and dives through the air and lands on the top of the crouched group. And the idea is to pile on there with great force and great rapidity and try to break down the team on below. And there's a certain technique of landing such a way that you introduce a slight twisting motion to your boys on top. So you're piling up and up on top of the gear and stretching your own team. You screw the thing over until finally there's a collapse. So it's a very simple elementary game, but it can be quite fun after, you know, after everyone's had a few drinks. I remember watching out of the corner of my eye this game on the billiard table while this other game was going on, and wondering how long it would be before fellows like Bredner and Billy Bishop would be able to resist getting into the more exciting game. And we reached a point where there was sort of an impasse. We were running out of. I was on the flying tackle team. Flying through the air side at that particular moment and trying to break down the anchor team below. And Bredner couldn't stand it any longer. He saw that we were running out of weight, and he was a pretty big fellow. And he put his cue against the wall, and he came over, and he joined our flying tackle team and crashed through the air and landed on top, and of course he screwed the thing completely over. And from that moment onward, the billiard game was, the game of the billiard table was terminated, and they all got into the fray. But there was a sequel to that, which I'll tell you. Interesting sequel. When Bredner, this was all done in one's mess kit, see. The mess kit were built to take this sort of treatment. They were...
They lasted up to them amazingly well, considering the treatment they got, you know.
They were rugged garments, and the material was, in the first instance, was very heavy, strong material, and the tailoring was absolutely the best. And most of these things were tailored in the UK, or by George E. Press of Ottawa, which is just as good a tailor as any of the British tailors. And they were taken off lots of punishment, but the chap as heavy as Bredner, diving on there and sort of doing a horseback type of landing where you're grabbing with your legs the person you're landing on and doing a twist using your legs as a means of twisting the whole formation over. He split his, I guess his mess kit was getting a little long. He split his trousers right from the crotch down almost to the ankle on the inside seam. And there was much amusement about that for the rest of the evening as he went around in that dilapidated gear.
I think that must be indigenous to pants. That's the article of clothing that I remember suffering by far the most damage in my own days in the army. The trousers would go.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't know why.
Well, the party, of course, wound up and was a great success. I think that was a Friday night, that party, and a week or so later, my friend John Easton was being married. He was being married a week, indeed 8 days later on the Bredner had been John Easton's boss all through his tour of duty there at the headquarters, and was very devoted to this chap Easton from the Americas. And he was going to be one of the principal officials at the wedding. We were, of course, all going to be there in full dress uniform, and full dress uniform made use of the same trouser that was worn with mess kit. That was the only common item. Well, Bredner had gone home the night of the mess dinner and put his gear away, and he was suffering no pain, and to the extent that he completely forgot that incident the next day, and didn't have any occasion to wear those trousers until the day of the wedding. And we used to work on Saturday mornings. Everybody worked on Saturday mornings at that stage. He didn't get home from the office, therefore, until sometime after midday, and the wedding was about 2 in the afternoon. He went up in due course after luncheon to get into his gear, got out his all his trappings, and pulled on his trousers to discover the state he was in. Great panic. Horrible situation. Nobody else in Ottawa had a pair of trousers big enough to fit Bredner. There wasn't an opportunity to call upon a friend. Well, fortunately, he got immediately on to George E. Preston, and Preston not only worked Saturday morning, but worked Saturday afternoons, too, in those days, so Preston was pressed into service, and at high speed, these things were made right for Bredner, and he went right from there to the wedding. He got there about 1 minute to the appointed hour, and
services of good tailor are indispensable, aren't they? They really have many occasions.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, that was one of the interesting highlights in trying to get John Easton married. He actually married a girl by the name of Anna McKenna, whose father was a civilian engineer with the at Army headquarters. He'd been a colonel in the Army in World War I, but he had gone into engineering, and I think I'm right in saying he was actually an architect more than an engineer. He did quite a bit of the design work for Army structures and buildings. The McKennas were related through Mrs. McKenna, I think it was, to Grattan O'Leary. That was first some of the pre-wedding parties. Had the opportunity of, well, we were invited out to Grattan's for Sunday afternoon tea on a couple of occasions. And my first chance to meet this distinguished Canadian. It's interesting through the years to know Grattan O'Leary, because he's really a great, great man and a great orator, a great speaker, and indeed one of Canada's leading politicians. He knew politics inside and out.
He was a fascinating man. Right?
He was he was a great man behind the scenes in the political party. In due course, he became a senator and was active right up into the 80s. And nobody could speak more effectively than Grattan, even at that age. Well, okay, we got Jack Easton married, and even off back to the UK. I took over from him. I don't know the exact date, but it would be sometime in the latter part of April. And in that period of time, I was busy doing a little bit of house hunting, because I had to get my family down, established, and it wasn't too easy even at that stage. It was not that housing would have been
relatively easy to come by in Ottawa, but Ottawa was developing, expanding, and the building wasn't keeping pace with the demand.
Were you thinking of renting, was it?
And in those days, one thought in terms of renting.
My
young officer moving around the country, at the rate that I'd been moving up to that time, didn't really think in terms of buying.
No, well, I know from my research, a succession of respectable boarding houses for a while until we could find a place to rent.
That's right. Well, there were one or two new structures being built in Ottawa at the time, and they were about to become ready. And then I heard of one of the officers in the Air Force headquarters was being posted. He came to me, and said, "I'm moving, and perhaps you'd like to take my house over to the." It was a charming and fine house down on the driveway, just adjacent to the Rio Canal. Housing in those days didn't cost very much. Seemed to me it was pretty damn expensive. But my predecessor, I guess he was squadron leader by that time, Squadron Leader Middleton, later Air Vice Marshal Middleton, was paying the vast sum of $45 a month for that house. And it was a sizable house. Is this thing working all right? Do you understand? Yes, I was just saying it was a sizable house. Five rooms downstairs and there were four bedrooms upstairs. And one of the downstairs rooms was a maid's room. And when we moved in there, the owner decided he was going to have to raise the rent.
Oh.
And it went up to $50 a month, and that sounded like a pretty severe increase to me, but of course we didn't hesitate to pay it because it was the house was absolutely worth it. What's the trouble?
Couldn't find my breath. That's all that trouble, man. Dear me, absolutely. Sorry. $50 a month. Well, it was fairly substantial in view of the rates of pay in those days. Proportionately.
However, the pay was pretty. It was still pretty meager. But we were able to rent that place and have a maid and have more. Come and go on, and it seems one had in one's more senior appointments.
A live-in maid. For $25 a month, probably.
Well, as a matter of fact, you hit it almost on the nose. I think the maid was $30 a month.
Yeah.
$25 or $30.
Plus uniforms, of course.
So there it went. We were able to take possession of that on 1st of May, so my wife arrived a few days after that from Vancouver, where she'd been visiting at her own parents' home there. And that, of course, Vancouver had been her place of birth, and she'd grown up in both Vancouver and Victoria. So she arrived, complete with young son. She'd been showing her our young son off and to the grandparents and all the relatives in the Vancouver area. She arrived back on about the 6th or 7th of May, just shortly before the arrival of the King and Queen. When she arrived back, I think we had a snow flurry that day. She didn't think too much of Ottawa. I guess this was the first time she saw Ottawa. But they'd been rather late in spring, and this was the final kick, because after that it got very warm all of a sudden. They just planted a line of trees on Elgin Street. Elgin Street was rushed. The broadening and widening of Elgin Street was rushed for completion by the arrival of the King and Queen. And part of the... And it was boulevarded down the center, as you... I remember it. And part of the plan of beautification was to plant these almost fully grown trees to make the thing look as though it had been in operation for a long time. They they brought those things into position while the roots were still frozen sometime in the latter part of March. Plunked them at the ground. First time I think anyone in Ottawa had ever seen large cranes used to hoist trees into position. And with the arrival of that warm weather, all of a sudden in the second week of May, out burst those leaves, and it was really quite a sight to see the way that rough construction area had been tamed, and sod had been laid, and trees were in bloom, and I think when the king and queen arrived and driven up and down there, they thought things had been, no doubt that it had been in growth there for a long period of time. But lots of things can be made to happen quickly under the stimulus of arrival of visiting dignitaries.
Indeed, yeah. One of their main functions in life, I think, is to visit people, visit around, get things done.
That's right. Well, let me see, where do we go from there? Well, let's get back to more official things. The situation, the world situation was deteriorating quite markedly in the summer of 1939, and what had been accomplished at Munich wasn't obviously going to stick. Peace in our time was going to be peace for a very short period of time, and in spite of Mr. Chamberlain's apparent optimism. I never really thought that Mr. Chamberlain, in spite of the things he said and the interpretations placed upon what he said, himself could have been inwardly too optimistic. But I think at the time he had to take that stance. I'm sure he wasn't too surprised that things did deteriorate. And Germany was getting more and more vociferous in her demands. And it was obvious that we were running into trouble. And, of course, the great shock and surprise came later in the summer when Germany signed this non-aggression pact with Russia. And when that happened, the fact was really in the fire because it freed Germany's hands to move eastward. And there were many who saw the writing on the wall. I guess the many, I shouldn't use the term many there because they were few in comparison with the people. But the vast majority who always were hopeful and optimistic that nothing like that would ever happen. But there were enough people amongst the forward lookers and forward planners to realize that we had to get ourselves in readiness for really for the possibility of war. So the summer of particularly the late summer, July through August, early August, was quite a busy time at trying to get the operational unit such as we had into shape. In our last session I made it quite clear that the operational aircraft in RCF squadrons were hopelessly obsolete and obsolescent. The things that we were calling obsolescent really were obsolete.
Just as a question, I didn't catch it the last tape. Why were the Hurricanes that we had stationed at Calgary? What was the point of putting them in the middle of the continent, if you will?
I really haven't got a good answer to that.
Just for training purposes, I presume. Would that be the answer?
No, I can't even suggest that perhaps was the answer. you would, is the most unlikely place to put them. It may have been that it may have been that they decided that they would put them someplace in the mid area of Canada, so they could go either way. As a matter of fact, perhaps this this may shed some light on that question of yours. Up until 1939, the main threat in the eyes of the planners was the threat in the Pacific. I'm not just, well, maybe I'll put that date a little. Up until about 38, early 38, yeah, 38. The Japs, you know, had been very active out in Manchuria and,
yes, indeed,
and so on. And we were looking a little bit more. We knew that there was trouble brewing in Europe, but the active fighting was taking place in the Orient. And the Japs... The Japs had been, and it had been discovered in the early 30s, were active in mapping areas of our west coast. They had members of the Japanese fleet out there operating as fishermen, and they were mapping the harbors on the west coast of Queen Charlotte Islands and places like that. And because of that, and the fact that that brought things very close to home, there was a tendency to give a little bit of priority, extra priority to the Pacific side in the matter of defenses than there was to the other uh-huh. side. And maybe it was felt that if they placed those Hurricane aircraft at Calgary, they would be close to the Pacific area and could quickly get over to the Pacific coast if there was any need to defend Vancouver, Victoria, and so on. Or they could quite rapidly, because of their speed and mobility, get down to the east coast if needed down there. So rather than put them on either one of the two coasts, since they only had one small group of hurricanes, they may have decided to put the guy. Whether that's a reasonable explanation or not, I don't know.
No, it did seem rather an odd place to
but
the station either.
But it's odd.
That's all we had, you know.
Yeah, even after... it is odd that after the activity of Germany and in Austria and Sudetenland and so on, we were still giving a little bit of higher priority to provision of defenses on the Pacific side here than we were to the Atlantic. So that may have had some influence on it, and the planning for the basing of the Hurricanes would have taken place perhaps in 1937, around like that. But the Hurricanes were ordered back in that period of time, so the plans would have been generated at that time to locate them out here, and that Pacific priority may have had some influence on it. Yeah. Well, the Hurricane, of course, was the only really modern aircraft in the inventory. There's a tendency to speak of the Strand Rares and the Sharks and things like that, and the Battles as being modern, but they weren't very great fighting aircraft by any stretch of the imagination. But there were lots of others that were much further removed from modern frontline, first-line aircraft than even they were. But the aircraft such as they were, and the squadrons such as they were, we had about a dozen squadrons earmarked at that time, and mainly, I guess there are about 10 of them actually in being. And they were understrength squadrons. They were... You could, if you had eight aircraft gathered together, you generally called it a squadron, although that was a pretty small squadron. Such as they were, many of them weren't really up to date in terms of their armament and their fighting capability. And that meant that all of a sudden in 1939 we got busy trying to get them equipped with their guns and their bomb racks and their bomb sites and so on, and trained.
You were still using Lewis guns, were you, on these aircraft? Or
yes.
Or you've gone from that?
The Lewis gun was still in use up until about that time. We introduced, we had new guns coming in at 39, but the Vickers and the Lewis guns were still in use up to into about 39. 38 and 39 saw some of the new weapons, the Brownings, and there was a new Vickers, a replacement for the Lewis gun. I think it was called the Vickers K or something like that. And of course, we were getting to the stage where power-operated turrets were under development and were indeed necessary. When the speed of the aircraft got beyond, the fighting speed of an aircraft got beyond 125 miles an hour, you couldn't expect a man to stand out there in the slipstream and operate a hand-operated scarf ring, as they were known as. You had to have some sort of power-operated turret. The Battle, I guess, was the first of the aircraft that we had that had such a device. It wasn't a very good one, but those were in the early days of power-operated turrets. They owned the things like the Atlas and the Wapiti. You know? We had more Wapitis, I guess, than most. Had a couple of squadrons of Wapitis. They still were using the scarf ring, and the gunner stood out there in the breeze from waist up. And the same thing with the Atlas. So it was still some time before we got into the power operated there. Territory, except in the case of the Battle. But there was a struggle to try and get all these things equipped and ready. In the case of, it was a bit of a futile effort. When I look back at it now, I think of the way we really labored tooth and nail to get every one of those aircraft complete and operational. We had, you know, wall charts that showed the state of every aircraft and what it was missing and what it needed. We bent every effort to get those things ready in time for any conflict, but even if you had them completely up to date with every required item of fighting equipment, the end product wasn't going to be very effective if it was ever put to the test.
Sort of a catch-22.
That's right.
You really had to do it. But, you know.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
So there was sort of panicky periods through that those months of July and August trying to get everything in shape.
I mean, you were, of course, an armament expert, and something that has puzzled me. You mentioned the Vickers K gun, and for some reason that had a fairly short life, even with the Air Force, who I think took most of them. The Army wouldn't buy it at all, and I wondered if there was.
Well, it didn't have much of a life with the Air Force either, because it wasn't suited to installation and turrets, in power operated turrets, and as soon as we, and. It wasn't very long after the war broke out that we were into aircraft that required power-operated turrets, and one had to use the same guns that were really used in the fixed positions in fighter aircraft were installed in the turrets.
Oh,
so you got down to a pretty well standard range of weaponry. We had Browning 303s and Browning 0.5s and in the turrets before very long, and it displaced all these other
Yes, right. Things. Well, I just wanted to...
Yeah. Well, we got into August, of course, and before that month ended, came that agreement between the Russians and the Germans. And with that, Germany was free to move against Poland, and before the month of August was out, the assault had been, the blitzkrieg took place against Poland. It was therefore only a matter of days before the war would be declared. If my memory serves me, it was about the fourth week of August that that agreement was, or was it, I guess it was about the fourth week of August that the Germans turned on Poland. And we took certain steps immediately, which were preparatory steps to mobilization. Canada was not at war, but you can take steps to mobilize, or you can take preparatory steps leading to mobilization before an actual declaration is made. And the first moves that were made were that all the aircraft that were out on civil air operations were recalled. Photographic survey operations were terminated, and other aircraft brought in to get the both the aircraft and the crews in position for other assignments. And I think within a day or so of that, all leaves were canceled for Air Force personnel. And certain warning orders went out. Indeed, I think some of them went out as early as mid-August to prepare for the transfer of squadrons to wartime bases. And you referred to the Hurricanes. That was one of the first squadrons that was ordered to be in readiness to move. And of course, also in Calgary at that time, with a squadron of Wapitis. The war station was the Atlantic seaboard. That was a long, long journey for the old Wapiti.
Yeah.
And the war station for the Hurricanes was in the east, so they had to do this long trek across country. The Atlases were still, I think, in Trenton. They had to get off to the East Coast. I guess those were the... And the Northrop Deltas, yeah. The Deltas that had been on photo survey operations were also designated to operate on coastal surveillance, on anti-submarine operations and patrol of shipping and so on. They had to, operating mainly in the Northwest Territories out of the Winnipeg base. They had to be brought down in and brought to Ottawa and prepared for the move to the East Coast. So all of that was taking place in those last 2 weeks of August. It wasn't until the 1st of September, if I have the right date, that Britain declared war. And, of course, Canada was not about to declare war until the House had been assembled. Mackenzie King had always said that Canada would not enter war unless it were determined by the representatives of the people. And so Parliament was assembled, and it was indeed the 10th of September before we made that declaration, which in some respects may sound a little bit lengthy, but it wasn't too wasn't too many days after the...
It was definitely an exercise in independence,
of course. That's right. Oh, of course.
Yes.
You bet it was.
Yeah.
Yes, and it was... he had to take into account the diverse composition of Canada and bring the people along and in such a manner that they didn't feel that they were being forced into somebody else's war without consent of the public at large. And he had the conscription, always had the conscription problem very much to the forefront of his mind, and had to walk a very tender and light course because of that. So we on the 10th of September were officially at war. By that time, of course, before the end of August, these squadrons had all moved. I guess some of the movement took place in the first two or three days of September, but the things were initiated before the end of August. I think somebody should write up the move of the Wapitis from Calgary to the East Coast. I've tried to get Claire Annis to do it. Unfortunately, I've never been able to get him down to it. He can tell some wonderful tales. He's a great raconteur, is Claire Annis. And I've heard him many times describe the move of the Wapitis. And it's really a kind of remarkable story. But to get him to sit down and write it up is quite another matter. And I don't think he's yet got around to doing it. But he was in charge of one of the flights. Jags Lewis, was the squadron commander, was in charge of the other. And the Wapiti was a comparatively short range, lumbering, slow. World War I type aircraft. At least I will always call it such, because it was the development of one of the de Havilland DH-4s or DH-9, I forgot which one.
Pretty large.
Simply re-engined.
Pretty large biplane then, was it?
Yeah. It was by today's standards it would be pretty small, but yeah, by those standards, fairly large. And slow, short range. They've done good work out in the Northwest Frontier where you it could get to fairly reasonable height, and speed wasn't the essence when you're dealing with the with the Afghans and so on. You didn't have to worry about speed in the aircraft, but I think that on that flight to the East Coast they must have staged about 7 or 8 times, and it took a fair number of days. Annis got down there in fairly quick order, but the flight that Jags Lewis was leading, one of the aircraft developed some engine trouble when they were down over Millinocket in Maine. It took them some time to get that far, but when they got over Millinocket, one of the aircraft had to go down. There was a little airstrip, gravel strip at Millinocket. And, of course, Jags took the whole flight down there. You know, he wanted to help this fellow out and thought they'd better stick together. Well, that caused a little bit of consternation in Ottawa when they discovered that half of one of the Canada's fighting squadrons was on the ground in Millinocket, Maine. They didn't mind them going in there and refueling, but they didn't want them to be there for any length of time because... the moment that Canada... This was prior to the declaration of war by Canada. The moment Canada declared war, there was a possibility they might be interned there.
Right, yes.
Not only
right.
The aircraft, but everybody else. So wires began to rush out of Ottawa to Lewis and telephone calls and whatnot to get out of there as quickly as he could. So eventually, Jags